but it changes how the physics will look quite a lot. The partners of photon and Z and the Higgses are not going to be the mass eigenstates, because after electroweak symmetry breaking, they are all spin a half particles that can mix. So they become four mass eigenstates that get called neutralinos. Similarly, the partner of the W and of the charged Higgs become two mass eigenstates, charginos, after the mixing. The galeno won't mix with anything because there's no other color octets, and the gravitino won't mix in general with anything in the minimal theory, at least. So I hope you start seeing this spectrum in the New York Times and lots of magazines, as well as on the archive, those names. Here's then the superpotential for the matter particles. You've all seen, and you commonly see in stringy papers, superpotentials for the gravity sector and moduli, but seldom for particles with standard model quantum numbers. These are written out, these are written in schematic form here, but for example, the term with mu is a sum over the SU2 indices of the doublets to make a singlet. And these terms are sums over color indices. This is the right-handed quark SU2 singlet, but color triplet. This is the quark SU2 doublet and color triplet, and you sum over the color indices. Y is the up-type Yukawa matrix with 3x3 in flavor space, then the Higgs matrix and indices in SU2 space, this doublet, and you make a singlet. So the superpotential is a singlet in all of the gauge spaces. The Yukawa couplings are dimensionless. They're the 3x3 family matrices that determine the masses of the quarks and leptons and the CKM elements and angles and phase. Once the Higgs gets valves, if this term gets a valve, then this has just got the two quark terms, so it's a piece of a mass matrix, but it's in general not diagonal. There are other couplings I'll show you on the next transparency. There have to be two Higgs doublets in the theory, because first, the superpotential is analytic in the superfields, as we saw yesterday. So you can't do the standard model trick of replacing this by its complex conjugate to give mass to the down-type quarks. You must put in a second doublet. Similarly, a completely independent argument is that in order for all the anomalies to cancel, which is important, you need a second Higgs doublet if you go through the details of the anomaly cancellation. Given that you insist on conservation of baryon number and lepton number as is observed experimentally, and I'll come to what these mean soon, then this is the most general thing you can write using the particle matter content of the standard model. This has to do with flavor physics then, with the Yukawa couplings. And notice then that that's flavor physics coming in the supersymmetry unbroken part of the basic physics of the theory. That isn't the only place it can come, but it'll come there. An easy way to see some of the structure of that is to just retain for a moment only the terms that have the largest Yukawa coupling for up-type, down-type, and leptons, charged leptons. Then you get this series of terms writing it out, so you can see right away that if this gets a valve, then that's a mass term for a top quark, and similarly there's one for a bottom quark. And you can see that you have off-diagonal transitions, so you get charge-changing interactions. You get then you get other vertices, because remember in the superpotential those are chiral superfields, and so you get terms in general where you replace any two of the particles or any even number of the particles at a vertex by their superfields. So you get many vertices all determined by the same coefficients, many, many tests of the supersymmetry of the theory if you could measure all of those quantities. They're usually not the most important ones because the Yukawa couplings are often small, but in a few cases they are. Now, just to remind you, this is the superpotential we wrote the soft breaking Lagrangian we wrote for the fields before we identify them. Now we're going to go and look at what they look like in the real physical extension of the standard model. So here's the most general, almost. soft breaking Lagrangian. The almost has to do with things like leaving out the phi squared phi terms I mentioned yesterday and a couple more things. So first, the Gluino and Wino and Nino terms, the U1 and SU2 and SU3 terms of the standard model, have coefficients which are complex masses. All of the coefficients in this soft breaking Lagrangian have dimensions of mass for fermions or mass squared for bosons. We know everything about the supersymmetric Lagrangian except the masses, given the standard model. So we have those three terms. Then we have, for the squarks, a 3x3 mass matrix, because the squarks don't have to be diagonal even if the quarks are. So the squark SU2 doublet, the right-handed squark up-type singlet, down-type singlet, the lepton doublet, and lepton right-handed singlet, all of the five matrices in the middle are 3x3 Hermitian matrices. Hermitian just because you have to make the Lagrangian be Hermitian. Then if you have terms that can make a Yukawa coupling, you can have another set of terms in the softly broken case with the scalars in it. And these A matrices, called trilinears usually, are simply complex matrices, so you add the complex conjugate of it to make it Hermitian. They're just plain old complex matrices full of parameters. If they're 3x3, they have 18 physical parameters in them. Then these guys are just real numbers because they're already got a Hermitian coefficient. And this term, little b, most commonly written this way, but in the literature sometimes it's written, little b has dimensions of mass squared, then sometimes it's written as a b with dimensions of mass times mu, or sometimes as an m3 squared or an m12 squared in older literature. The important thing to understand, even apart from details, is that with this Lagrangian, we can do real useful phenomenology. If you've looked, for most of you, at the history of the top quark, it's a similar situation. The top quark was known to exist from 1981 or so, but there was no evidence of it seen until LEP ran. And at LEP, they didn't see the top quark directly. It was too heavy. But they could look at virtual top quarks and loops contributing to shifts in the W and Z masses and decay branching ratios. And the mass of the top quark was almost as well measured at LEP from its role as a virtual particle above the energy threshold of the machine as it could have been at, as it eventually was or is being measured at Fermilab, say, where you can produce it directly. The point is that you can assume a mass for the top quark, and then you know everything. You know all its couplings. You can calculate its role in quantum fluctuations and as production at a collider and decays. Do everything about it for that mass you assume, and then figure out if it is consistent with what you see or not. And determine, therefore, a range of allowed values, a lower limit at colliders, and a mass range from virtual effects. We can do that here. We can assume a set of masses, calculate the production cross-sections at Fermilab or the LHC, calculate the effects of the superpartners in quantum corrections like the one I showed you yesterday, where it may be showing up in the BDKs, and do everything we want with those for a set of masses. No theory yet predicts masses of any kind. There are no predicted masses. That's the job of string theory to do, and it has not succeeded in doing that so far. But we can do all these things along without a knowledge of the masses, but testing for any given set of masses. There are two subjects that I'm going to talk about next. One is about R parity, and first the mu problem opportunity. What that's about, and it's extremely important, and it's got to be basically in the domain of string theory, so it should be kept track of in an important way there. We could write this term in the superpotential a couple transparencies ago. If you look then at the Lagrangian, you get a lot of contributions to the Higgs sector. We wrote out this term, and so it contributes to the Higgsino mass matrices, for example. If you look at the F terms, where you take the derivative of the superpotential and then square it, you get these terms to the scalar Higgs potential itself. coefficient mu in terms that enter in. You get more F terms contributing to the Squark and Slepton mass matrices that involve mu and so forth, the neutralinos, charginos, everywhere mu shows up. So we can then figure out that if mu were where it apparently should be, since this is in a supersymmetric part of the theory, mu then should normally have a value. It's got dimensions of mass at a scale like the string scale, the unification scale, Planck scale, 10 to the 16 GeV or something. In that case, all of these mass matrices would immediately jump up to that scale, and the whole kinds of set of things that supersymmetry might do for us would go away. So that's been called the mu problem. Of course, we should think of it as a clue to what kind of underlying theory doesn't have a mu in the superpotential at the high scale, but mu gets generated to be of the same order as the other particles when supersymmetry is broken. So in fact, string theory may be doing the right thing there in the sense that the spectrum of particles we look at, we expect to be the massless modes of the string theory. And so if mu is zero at the string scale, that would fit in with that. And then by the non-renormalization theorem, mu wouldn't be regenerated until you got to the level where supersymmetry was effectively broken. Whether this kind of mechanism can really work is unclear, but it might. Phenomenologically, well, I'll show you the next transparency briefly before I finish this. Mu is known to be greater than approximately 100 GeV from certain kinds of experimental information about those, the masses of Higgses and charginos and so forth. How it's generated, I won't go into much detail about because there are ways to do it, but none of them are clearly compelling or seem to work. And it is one of the ways that you can really get important clues about the underlying theory, presumably. Here's what's basically known about its numerical values. It doesn't really matter what's plotted on this scale. You use some other parameter. But here's mu and 100 and minus 100 GeV and so forth. And it has to be above these lines where tangent beta, which we still haven't really defined, but we will today, tangent beta, as it varies from 5 to 30, gives you a range here, which isn't too big. What you see is that asymptotically, for other parameters, it mu up here can be within about plus or minus 100 GeV, but larger values are excluded if other quantities are smaller. So if you have a theory of it, then this kind of information will help you know what is going on. The other similar kind of thing is called R parity for historical reasons. The superpotential that I wrote isn't general. You can have these three terms in addition. The reason we don't write them is because those three terms violate baryon and lepton number conservation. In the standard model, baryon and lepton number were conserved perturbatively in an accidental way. There's no fundamental reason why they're conserved in the standard model, but the standard model Lagrangian doesn't allow decays that violate them. Here, if you combine the second and third terms, you can have quarks that turn into a lepton and other quarks, and so the quarks and the proton can turn into a lepton and decay, and you get very rapid proton decay in general. There are two possible approaches to this problem. One is you can, for example, set one of these two coefficients, the lambda or lambda prime, the indices ijk are flavor indices in general. You can set one of them to zero and arbitrarily forbid proton decay. I and a lot of other theorists don't like that because we don't like arbitrarily setting some term to zero. We expect if a term is zero that it's supposed to show up as zero in a clean, theoretical argument. Second, if such terms were present, then the Leydig superpartner would become unstable too, if you look at it in detail, and we like to have that as a dark matter candidate. Third, a large class of theories do conserve what I'll define on the next transparency, some sort of parity that basically forbids a decay involving those, forbids the presence of those terms when you look at deeper theories. I won't take the time to go here into examples of that. I'll just talk about what happens. But it's a symmetry you have to impose on the theory if you think of it as a low-scale theory. For example, R parity has eigenvalues minus 1 to 3 times b minus l plus twice the spin, and it's multiplicatively conserved by assumption in the low-scale theory. Then the standard model particles and Higgs's are even and superpartners are odd. It treats the pieces of a supermultiplet differently, and it's sufficient to forbid those terms. A discrete C2 symmetry. Symmetries like this do arise in string theories. There are examples. And then one just has to ensure that they're not broken until you get to the, that is, till you have them still at the low scale. In general, you get complete symmetries at the high scale, and then residual parity symmetries like this at the low scale. An equivalent one is not including the spin dependence, then it's called matter parity. It also forbids those terms in W. This doesn't treat the members of a supermultiplet differently, but it does treat gauge and Higgs fields differently from the matter, quark and leptons. So it's a kind of matter parity. It does commute with supersymmetry then, and equally well forbids that. If either of these kinds of things hold, as then we expect, you get three remarkable predictions. One is if you take any standard model particles X and Y, then to produce superpartners, you have to have a continuous line going through any diagram. So you'll produce always a pair of superpartners, and that'll be true whether you're colliding these or whether something is decaying. If something's decaying, then it has to decay into an even number of superpartners that is zero or two or more, so they can occur in loops, and you can get a pair of them, but you can't get single superpartners unless you start with a superpartner and keep an odd number. So to be explicit then, each superpartner will decay into an odd number, and the lightest one will have to be stable just because there aren't lighter ones. So by energy conservation, it has to work. These are just three notes that are asides. The argument about R parity being conserved is even stronger if you have a grand unified symmetry. Without it, you can imagine maybe some trick, but with the grand unified symmetry, you can actually show that you can't ever get a way to suppress the rapid proton decay. The favorite way of doing baryogenesis, which I won't talk about in general, is leptogenesis. That is, you generate heavy right-handed neutrinos, and then they have decays into matter and not matter through having a CP violating effect. If that's true, then you probably, if that's the mechanism which nature uses, you probably must have the R parity conservation when you go through the details of such theories. And you might ask, how do we get neutrino masses at all if we have that kind of lepton number violation? But the answer is that neutrino masses violate lepton number by 2 units, so it doesn't interfere with this. The mu problem or opportunity and the R parity one are both things where if you view the theory as a low energy effective theory only, then it looks like you have a weakness in the theory that is complicated. But if you view them as part of a high scale theory, then it makes sense to have them, and typically theories that people write as models in fact do have them. So it is more a way to probe the high scale theories. Now, we want to count the number of parameters in the theory. There are a lot, as we'll see in a minute, but I want to emphasize again that those parameters are all physical mass quantities. That's the only things we don't know are masses, because we have no theory that can compute them. The masses in the supersymmetric part of the Lagrangian are mainly complex, so you get a lot. Some of the masses are not flavor diagonal, too. So these five matrices give 45 real parameters because they're Hermitian. These three complex matrices have 18 each, give 54. B and mu are complex parameters, and the Gugino masses are complex, so that's 10 more, and these are two more real ones. You can absorb four of them by field redefinitions, only four. Basically, every time you have something that's conserved or a symmetry, then you can rotate something and absorb a parameter. So baryon number and lepton number are conserved. And there are two accidental symmetries in the Lagrangian. Whenever you have a symmetry such that if mu and v, the term, the coefficients in the Higgs sector, if you put them to zero, then you can do a rotation, of which an example is given here, but there are many ways you could do it. Then you have a symmetry. Such symmetries are called Peche-Quinn symmetries, for historical reasons. You also have an accidental R symmetry where the members of the supermultiplet are treated differently. And again, if you put certain things to zero, then you can do the rotation. Then when this comes back, you still don't lose the field redefinition opportunity. So finally, you can eliminate four of those. If you want to really count, you have to go through the details yourself and see it, but that's what's happening. In the Higgs sector, there were two parameters in the standard model, so and we're calculating them here, as I will show you in detail in a few minutes, so let's not count those. Then the standard model itself has the three gauge couplings and the quark and charged lepton masses and the CKM flavor rotation matrix and the strong CP phase. So there's altogether 124 parameters in the supersymmetric standard model. 45 of those are masses, 43 of them new from the super phases, 43 of them new from the supersymmetry sector. 8 of those phasers don't depend on flavor, and the rest do. All the parameters can be assigned to physical processes. They affect observable things in principle. In practice, it'll be hard to measure them. I didn't count the gravitino, which has a mass and which can be complex. So you want to add two more if you want to include that. Those parameters determine what happens, how the electroweak symmetry is broken. They determine the masses and the cross-sections for production and the decays of Higgs bosons. They determine superpartner masses and cross-sections and decays, the dark matter relic density in the universe, and the cross-sections of dark matter to scatter on nuclei and be detected or to annihilate. They determine what happens in baryogenesis and lots of rare decays and electric dipole moments and many kinds of things that aren't even listed there. I'll mention the neutrino sector briefly in a few minutes for completeness, but I didn't include it yet here. So the total number is really more. The parameters will have to either be calculated with a compelling theory or measured experimentally to test theory. The number that are masses are fewer than you might think. There's one galeno mass, there are four neutralino masses, two chargino masses, four in the Higgs sector, we'll see in a few minutes, three neutrinos in the minimal theory, charged leptons, six charged leptons, left and right-handed, and up and down type quarks, each six. And you can add the graviton mass. I have the only parameter I can't imagine finding a way to measure yet is the gravitino phase. I have no clue on how to measure that. But all the rest, I can tell you some experiment in principle that can measure them. And the tangent beta, that's the ratio of the Higgs valves. So that plays a kind of big role in the low scale theory. So there are 34 of them that you could measure, for example, with collider physics and such things. The rest are phases that you'll have to measure through electric dipole moments and CP violation experiments in rare decays and such things, and flavor-changing interactions. In practice, all the masses are actually eigenvalues of mass matrices, where the parameters of the mass matrices are from the soft Lagrangian. I'll show you an example of this, but the eigenvalues aren't. So the experimental quantities you measure are not in the theorist Lagrangian. Two of them could be measured directly, maybe. That's all. So this reiterates some of that, but the bottom point, if you go back to what I was talking about yesterday about measuring, what we can measure that'll tell us about underlying theories, including any form of string theory and cosmology, then is soft raking Lagrangian, the mu parameter, which isn't directly in the Lagrangian but can be thought of as a supersymmetry parameter, The strong CP angle might be non-zero, and we can measure that. The neutrino stuff, which I won't talk much about. Maybe some axion physics and cosmology, the inflaton sector and dark energy. Those are the things that we can measure about the world to get experimental constraints on the philosophy otherwise. If we include the neutrino sector, it depends how you do it, and that's not yet settled. But for example, if we add to the superpotential terms for neutrinos, here's the charged lepton term that's already in the superpotential. Then a neutral term just like that for the neutrino, which is the uptight part of an SU2 doublet. And then the Majorana mass terms would have a piece like this, if N is the name of the Majorana masses. So if you go through and count, again, you get 21 physical parameters from these matrices, assuming three families, and of which we counted three charged lepton masses before, so 18 new ones. And those include six real mixing angles, and they include six CP phases in that mixture. And from this, you could get a seesaw neutrino mass spectrum, if that's the actual way neutrinos are generated. So, well, I think I've already said everything on this transparency. You can not only do phenomenology once you have data, you can plan for data, figure out what you could measure at different machines, figure out the limits on the parameters, and all such things. There's two interesting subtleties if you want to sort of look at homework problems that indicate you understand what's going on. These neutrinos have masses, and in general, this neutrino mass matrix is not diagonal. So separate, in supersymmetry, the E and mu and tau numbers are not conserved separately the way they are in the standard model. So you can have interactions which violate those, and they should show up experimentally. And you can have all sorts of interesting and complicated phenomena involving lepton number violating results. Total lepton number is conserved because no interactions lead to disappearance. So these have to, if one of them disappears, another one has to appear. But that's a substantial prediction of supersymmetry then, in general, that could show up experimentally and could be detectable even in colliders. The analysis of counting the parameters we did at the high scale, we'll see that after electroweak symmetry breaking, it'll be obvious because that Peche-Quinn symmetry keeps a Higgs neutral, and so once you have electric symmetry breaking, that symmetry will be broken. So we lose one of the symmetries. So it looks like in the low scale theory, you can rotate away one fewer parameter. It looks like the parameter counting changes from high scale to low scale. And a nice challenge is to figure out what happens. The answer is if you go to the minimum of the Higgs potential, then you can rotate the phase of B away, not in general, in the soft breaking parameter B away. And that restores that extra, or takes away that extra parameter. But showing that is non-trivial in terms of going through the steps. Since the phases are potentially extremely important, I want to emphasize that over and over again, because when you write down a string theory, people don't normally pay attention to the phases, but the geometry of the compactification can forbid or allow a phase structure, phase in the sense of complex masses. And that could, whether it does or not, could be a big clue to the kind of string theory that you have. Similarly, supersymmetry breaking can allow, for example, F terms to get complex vacuum expectation values or only real ones. And that, again, can affect a lot how you do things. So you need to understand the phases. The longest review of the phases is several pages in the Chung et al. Review article. But there are various ways to look at it. One thing you can do is treat the fields and the masses of the particles as effective fields, and you can give charges to all the parameters in the theory and to the, all the fields. And so you can let each terminal Lagrangian be such that it has no net charge under the assignment of charges. Then the when you do that, then any rotation that leaves the charge invariant is one that is simply reparameterizing the fields rather than doing something observable. So various combinations, and I'll show you one in a practical way in a little while, or next time probably, various combinations of phases are invariant under reparameterizing the phases. So it's something you have to be sure is true if you're doing any work with those things, that you're working, your answers occur only for reparameterization invariant combinations. It's also, if you do the calculations without imposing it, it's a very good way to check calculations and see that you finally get something like that. As I said, the you can break the symmetries with BEVs, but this, there's a particular combination of the R accidental U1 symmetry and the Peche-Quinn one that has the scalar BEVs neutral. So then when Higgs get a BEV, that combination doesn't change. And so looking, dealing with the low-scale electroweak symmetry breaking theory by choosing this as one of the U1 symmetries that the Lagrangian has, a linear combination of the two that you kind of naturally discover at high energies, that can be a very useful, practical thing to do in calculations. The renormalization group running of the phases is written down originally in a paper of Martin and Vaughan two decades ago. And in the review article, the phase of mu, partly related to the non-renormalization theorems, doesn't run. And so it's something that connects high and low scale physics directly. If you measure it at low scales, you know what it is in the string scale theory. The phase of the Gugino masses doesn't run at one loop. And so barring very large things, which don't obviously occur in an expression like this, the phase of the Gugino masses remains generally pretty small. The phase of the trilinears can be very large depending on the ratios of masses. And it has a Gugino mass here, which might not be small, and a big color coefficient, and the gauge coupling of the SU3 group, which is large. So you can generate large phases. That is a theory which at the high scale has no phase. For example, for that trilinear, you can still generate one from the phase of the Gugino part of the theory and generate a large phase that can affect CP physics in kaon physics and B physics and collider physics and lots of places. If you view the soft Lagrangian parameters as arbitrary, there are also flavor-changing constraints on them that are important, and that comes about in a simple way. That's here. Let me mention the relic density one, since that's what's written at the top. The relic densities depend on the soft Lagrangian parameters, and I'll show you a little bit more about that later, but not much. For lack of time. But there are parameters in the Lagrangian which would give too large a relic density and overclose the universe, or more precisely violate the known WMAP upper limit on the relic density. So those are simply excluded. And that's not one parameter that does that. There's some complicated kind of sum rule that says that a certain function of half a dozen parameters that determine that relic density has to be larger or smaller than some particular number, depending on how you calculate it. Let's turn to the flavor part. Then in the flavor part, just imagine for the moment two families to see how it goes. You diagonalize, say, the quark part of the sector. So downstrange, you have a 2x2 mass matrix. You find rotation matrices which diagonalize that. But the Lagrangian of the full theory has to be simultaneously rotated. You can't just rotate part of the Lagrangian. So the squark part gets the same rotation, but in general, it won't be diagonalized by the same transformation. So you'll end up with a non-zero off-diagonal element. that, for this case, could connect D and down type and strange type squarks. And these would be different in general. So if a strange squark is propagating, it can turn into a down squark. And the example I showed you yesterday of the potentially visible decay is where a bottom squark turns into a strange squark. If you look at the lepton part, just to change again to show you different things, a muon can turn into a selectron. So you can have a diagram with a muon that gives a decay into electron photon by having this muon change into a selectron with a parameter delta there. And this could be a Beno gauge particle, for example. And then you would get a rate, something like alpha and a suppression factor from the loop, and delta divided by some squark or lepton mass squared would come in squared. And the experimental branching ratio is less than 10 minus 11. But these numbers are in front are of order 10 to the minus 6 or so. And so this ratio has to be like 10 to the minus 5. And so when you unsquare it, you still have to have something that is much smaller than 1 to agree with this. But it's not obvious from this rotation why this should be much smaller than those. And so there's clearly something going on in the theory that is constraining it. In fact, rare processes like this should have been seen if all the supersymmetry parameters are of order 1. And that's one of the fine-tuning issues that I mentioned last time. It'll help locate the right theory when you find theories that do suppress naturally some of these things. That could happen in many ways. There's at least 3 relatively clear ways how that could happen. First, it could happen that all the different squark and lepton type matrices are proportional to unity. That could happen in a theory. And then when you rotate degenerate states, you can always diagonalize them in such a way that you don't get effects like that. The effects could be in the trilinear terms and involve the Yukawa couplings as well, but again, there's ways the theory could take on a form where that doesn't happen. Second, the squark and lepton matrices could be proportional to the quark and lepton Yukawa couplings. That again could happen in a theory, and it actually does happen in string theories typically if the Yukawa couplings have no dependence on the moduli. Then the other matrices tend to be proportional to these. And so you can get effects which make that kind of problem go away. Third, it could be that what's sensitive to are really the first and second families. And it could be that they're simply very heavy squarks and leptons. So then it's the denominator being large that suppresses those terms rather than numerator effects. There are similar effects on the CP phases. I'll just mention that here, and then later I'll go into some details on it to show you how it works in real examples. But in general, electric dipole moments are proportional to the imaginary parts of diagrams where electrons, for example, flip chirality and emit a photon. If you look at such operators and take their imaginary parts as contributing to matrix elements, then you get a CP violating electric dipole moment. So if the Gugino masses in mu are complex with phases of order 1, then you would tend to get an electron EDM of order 10 to 50 times the current limits on finding it, and we don't know why. So a great outcome would be if all the phases were 0. That would get rid of 43 of the soft Lagrangian parameters, and it would tell us that the underlying theory had a basic structure that didn't give rise to phases, which would really constrain dramatically the kinds of theories that you could write in string theory. But there's really only 2 measurements of electric dipole moments that they constrain several phases in some sense, but or combinations that come in because you have different superpartners coming in. But we don't know enough to really conclude that. But we'll be able to study these better experimentally from this sector and from CP violating other kinds of physics, including colliders. eventually. The interesting thing is that nobody has ever given an argument why phases should be zero in the supersymmetric effective theory. No symmetry has ever been shown for a string theory which would imply that phases should be zero. No one's ever written down any kind of dynamical or symmetry argument that implies that phases should be small. But the only data we have is suggestive of that. So that's another challenge that could point the way to underlying string theories. Now let me turn to electroweak symmetry breaking and go into detail about the Higgs sector of the theory. That's where supersymmetry, at least theoretically, does a great job. And I mentioned that there's a little bit of fine-tuning in that Higgs should have been seen according to this point of view. And I'll explain now that in great detail. The Higgs physics, the Sander model must have a Higgs mechanism to generate masses for the quarks and leptons. Experimental data that I'll mention implies that Higgs bosons do exist. But the form that the Higgs sector takes will not only complete the standard model, but it'll really point the way to the kind of high-scale theory we will have. So one of the, in a sense, the nearby goal is to learn how the Higgs sector looks experimentally and interpret that. But our real deeper goal is to have a full understanding and derivation of the Higgs physics. So let me remind you that to break the electroweak symmetry of the standard model, you assume in an ad hoc way this potential with no justification. To explain it, first you would have to show that the parameter mu squared is in the TEV region and not very large. Second, you would have to show that it was negative in the standard model, so you get a minimum away from the origin. Third, you have to derive the coefficient lambda and show that it's both positive and of order the gauge coupling. In fact, in the supersymmetric case, the reason for the fine-tuning is that lambda comes out not to be g squared itself, but something like a tenth of g squared. And that's the origin of the fine-tuning, effectively. And we'll see how that calculation goes. Here's the basic piece. The key point is that supersymmetry does calculate the Higgs potential. So supersymmetry takes the standard model and says Higgs physics fits in. And here is the Higgs potential that should describe the standard model. And we wrote down all these terms. The first line is the F term we wrote, where you take the derivative of the scalar potential and square it. The second line is the D term part, where it connected from the gauge sector. And you get a minus sign between those two terms, which is important. And you can calculate the coefficient. So this is the phi to the fourth piece of the standard model. And here is the coefficient that you calculate. And then you get the soft breaking terms, the third line of the terms from the soft sector. Notice that except for the B term, everything is positive definite. So if you're going to have a minimum away from the origin, well, this is positive definite too here. Everything but the B term is positive definite. So this just writes out the F terms and the D terms explicitly for you. If you want to go through the algebra of seeing it's essentially all written there, you can do it in your head from what is explicitly written in terms of summing over the indices. And here it is with the D term, where you have the generators of the SU2 group coming in for HU and the generators of the U1 symmetry, one being charged, one being plus a half and one minus a half. So now we want to minimize this. Now, I didn't write the charge parts of this. If we'd included the full scalar Lagrangian, including all the charge parts, that's something you want to do, because if you had a valve that was non-zero for a charge part, you would break the electroweak symmetry. What you find is that at the minimum, electromagnetism is unbroken because you can use the gauge invariance to rotate in such a way that the valves are purely in the neutral sector. B is complex, remember, but we can redefine the phases of HU and HD to absorb the B phase. And in fact, we can choose it to be real and positive in complete generality. then this term subtracts the most, so the minimum will occur when it's the largest, and you can kind of see what is happening. These can be chosen real and positive for the same reason. And in fact, since they have opposite hypercharge, plus and minus, the two BEVs can be chosen separately, real and positive. That means at tree level, in the Higgs sector, there is no CP violation. That's only true at tree level, and I'll indicate how the radiative corrections can introduce actually fairly significant CP violation. So I'm not writing every line, but you can almost do the arithmetic in your head for this stuff by using those gauge invariance arguments to simplify. So you find the minimum by just taking the derivative of the potential with respect to the two fields. And then a couple lines of algebra show you that the minimum is away from the origin. So you get a non-zero vacuum expectation value if B is not too small. We already saw last time, and you can see from what was on the last transparency, that if B is zero, you get no electroweak symmetry breaking at all. You can in fact see that it's got a minimum away from zero. So in the standard model, you needed mu squared of the standard model. It's not the same mu, of course. That's one of the great things about the way the theory is always written, is that we introduce the same term for several different things to make sure that you're keeping track, otherwise you get confused. So the mu of the standard model is unrelated to our mu parameter. These in the standard model, these masses squareds, or this one in particular, would have to be negative. Here, in supersymmetry, they don't have to be negative. It helps if they're negative, because then it makes it easier for this right-hand side to be smaller than the left-hand side. And we'll see that they tend to be negative, but it's not absolutely required. So the first important result is that if there's no supersymmetry breaking, then there's no electroweak symmetry breaking. We already saw that, but here it is. In particular, it's the B term that matters. Second, you have to input a guarantee that the potential is unbounded from below, not unbounded from below. And so that, if you look at it for a minute, amounts to the requirement that B is less than something involving those same masses. And that can get a little subtle if this is negative, so you have to be a little careful there. And what you quickly see is that if these two mass squareds are equal, then you can't simultaneously satisfy this condition and this one. So that's another important constraint on the theory. We are looking at the Higgs mechanism at the low scale, but we start in a high scale theory, so we want to look at the renormalization group running. I'm mostly going to assume you've had renormalization group running in a field theory course. Here's the renormalization group equations for MHU squared, MHD squared, and for some of the quark states, which are important. Basically, it just comes from diagrams like this. For MHU, you can have a one-loop diagram which has in-the-loop top quarks, stops, charged W bosons, and lots of other particles. And so if you have top quarks or stops at the vertex, you get a Yukawa coupling. If you have a W boson, you get a gate coupling. Still here. thought if I pretended I was going to write on the blackboard, it would be enough to convince it to come back, but let's see what happens. So let me keep going on the blackboard and we'll see if we get... Ah, cool. Is that right? Yeah, okay, great. Good, so pretending worked. So, if you just write down these one loop diagrams, then you get those renormalization group equations from the one loop running. Xt is a quantity that comes up all the time. It's written here. For the h up squared term, you get a Yukawa coupling from the top loop. Here, you get the Squark term. And so forth. The details don't matter. But Xt has a large Yukawa coupling. Xb has a B-type Yukawa coupling in here. So the top Yukawa coupling is of order 1, and the B Yukawa coupling is of order mb over mw. So this is much larger quantity. And so the important thing is shown here. In the renormalization group running, if you run down, and if you have a quantity that's the difference of two terms, for example, and the second one is smaller, then it goes towards zero as you run down from a high scale. So what you see is that m squared hu has both the largest numerical coefficient and the largest mass coefficient, coefficient with dimensions of mass squared. So it runs more than any of the other things. And that's exactly what you need to get the electroweak symmetry breaking. The m squared hu runs down to be typically negative or nearly negative. And that induces the Higgs mechanism that in the standard model you had to assume occurred here. It's derived. That is, I'll show you again on the next transparency. But at high scales, there is no Higgs mechanism. There is no minimum away from the origin. That gets induced naturally by the theory. Now, if any of these other terms had had a bigger coefficient, for example, if this one had, you would get a valve for a squark that carries electric and color charge, and you would completely screw up the vacuum, and nothing would work at all. These have to run less, or else it wouldn't work. So it's a highly non-trivial and rather profound effect that in supersymmetry, exactly the right kind of running occurs to naturally explain the fact that the electroweak symmetry is broken. You don't put in that breaking the way you do in the standard model. It's an output of the theory. And that's conceivably its most profound result. The typical running of all the superpartner soft Lagrangian states is here. So this dark blue line is the m squared hu. You have to write the scale kind of tricky because it's a mass squared that runs and it goes negative, but that's hard to show on the same scale unless you're a little careful. The particles with color, gluinos and squarks, they run up if you look at their renormalization group equations. They get bigger at small scale. And the others stay more or less constant with a small change. They just have no big color-dependent or top mass-dependent coefficients. What you pick up here doesn't really matter very much. You can see that if you shift these around, you still get a separation of MHD and MHU as needed for electroweak symmetry breaking, and you make it easier. So it's a very robust result that doesn't depend at all on picking a small part of the parameter space. A really important result. You proceed then by letting the Higgses get valves away from the origin. That is, they do automatically get valves. So then you calculate MZ just as you do in the standard model. You take the covariant derivative of the Higgs terms and the rest, where the covariant derivative has in it the gauge terms. And so when you square that, you get terms with just this thing squared, and its coefficient is the Higgs p squared, which when it gets a valve, leads to terms like this, which are mass terms for the W. So in particular, if you write it down for the Z, you see that MZ squared is proportional with gauge couplings to the sum of squares of those. And if you put in the numerical value here, notice you're inserting an experimental number here. You're taking the Z number from the experiment to do that, to get rid of one combination of parameters. And the ratio is called tangent beta. So you could write these two lines then. And that's the typical way you deal with this phenomenologically. And remember, you've put in a number that by making this relation. Then these are the two most important equations in all of supersymmetry physics, because they're they relate a known experimental number to the soft Lagrangian and the new parameter. These are the only equations in all of supersymmetry physics that relate known real-world data to the theory. No others. They're just the two equations from the minimization conditions and insisting that the vacuum be bounded from below. What we would like is that first principles allow us to calculate the soft Lagrangian and the mu term and the B parameter of the soft Lagrangian, and that we get tangent beta by actually doing that renormalization group running, letting a minimum of the potential be generated away from the origin, calculating those valves. We would like to do all of that from the theory and then calculate MZ analytically and predict it. That's what the ultimate goal would be. Any good string theory can do that, of course. But so far, it hasn't been done. So since it hasn't been done, what we do is put in the numerical value of MZ, treat tangent beta like a parameter. And with that, we can trade two of these, for example, for MZ and tangent beta. Or often you eliminate B and the magnitude of mu, but not the phase of mu when you then do that in practice. But that, we hope, is a temporary way of doing it until the theory is better. So it's easy to count the physical states, then you actually count just like in the standard model. In the standard model, three gauge bosons eat three of the Goldstone bosons that get heavy, and that same thing happens here. But here you have two doublets, and so you have eight real degrees of freedom, and three are the ones that are eaten, and so you're left with five, which turn into, at tree level, two CP even scalars. I'll explain in a minute why they're CP even. And one CP odd scalar and a charged pair, so 5 degrees of freedom. We won't take time to go through the Higgs mass matrix calculation here for lack of time, but you define a mass matrix by simply taking the second derivative of the potential with respect to the real and imaginary parts of all of the Higgs fields and go to the minimum. And then you get all the masses, you get a set of relations for all the masses in terms of those parameters. There's one point to make. If you look at the mass squared of the CP even part, that's a 2x2 matrix. The others, the odd one under CP and the charged ones, don't mix with anything. Here you get a 2x2 matrix, and you diagonalize it and get an eigenvalue equation for the two masses of these guys. you get one rotation angle called alpha. So there's an angle alpha in the theory from rotating this. So we have another parameter. We have alpha and beta as the two rotation angles. If you look at this formula a minute, ma squared plus mz squared, here ma squared plus mz squared squared minus 4 ma squared z squared cosine 2 beta. If you just stare at that a second, you can see that if you put ma to 0, then the lighter one of these is 0. And if ma gets very large, so you can drop mz, then again the lighter one of these is 0. So the lighter one is a positive definite number that simply starts out at 0 and rises up and comes back down to 0 for large MA. And so it has a maximum. You can't quite see what the maximum is without a few lines of algebra, but it clearly has a maximum. And it turns out that the maximum is MZ, and for the square is MZ squared times cosine squared of 2 beta. So the tree level theory, and this is another profound prediction, the tree level theory, the MSSM, has a maximum value for the Higgs mass. Maximum values are great because then you can't have something bigger. we'll see that you have to include radiative corrections to test it. You can also, with a similar argument, see that there's a lower limit on the charge one. And at tree level, you can parameterize the theory in terms of two parameters. Now, there has to be an important one-loop correction. The loops are calculated up through fully through two loops. And there's one big term, because you can have lambda, the coefficient of phi to the fourth, or h to the fourth, can get from top loops a term with couplings, Yukawa couplings of order one here. So that is naturally enhanced by the size of those Yukawa couplings. A way to estimate crudely its size is write its renormalization group equation. So it'll run, and now this mu is the renormalization group parameter mu. It's not any of the other mu's. And that's the Higgs mass scale. And this diagram has to give something like m top to the fourth and a logarithm of that mu. So qualitatively, apart from exactly what the coefficient is, you know that you have to get an equation like this. And the sign comes from the scalar RG running. So then you can, the Higgs mass squared is its lambda times the Bev squared from minimizing the potential. And so you can then use this and substitute that in. And you see that you get this extra enhanced value going like m top to the fourth over mw squared, or the mass squared of the Higgs. So the real limit, or the real value of the Higgs mass, is the tree level limit plus the radiative correction contribution, which is numerically quite non-trivial. And if you put in numbers, you get a number like about 130 is the upper limit in the MSSM. It looks like this. And this is important because of the experimental situation. Since the tree level upper limit is proportional to cosine squared of beta, 2 beta, let's keep tangent beta being the parameter. Then as tangent beta increases, the cosine squared of 2 beta goes toward 1. So you get an upper tree level limit, which is around here, of 91 GeV from the Z term. And the radiative correction term gives you a logarithm which very slowly grows, but saturates more or less around 130. So the Higgs mass suggests, since the experimental limit that is below which it would have been seen if it's standard model-like at LEP, and I'll talk more about this, but this is the number where experimentally it should be excluded below here if it's a standard model-like Higgs. That suggests tangent beta is greater than 5 or 4 or some number around there, or else you would have trouble reaching that limit. Here's a side remark that's useful if you look in any detail. To make things work, you need a stop mass that's in about the right region. And there are three reasons that all hold why stop masses are probably kind of unrelated to other squark masses. You wouldn't expect the stop and the other squarks to all have the same mass. The first is that if you look back to that RGE running, the stop mass term has a big coefficient and a Yukawa term. It's not quite as big as the MHU, but it's big. And so the same way that the renormalization group running reduces MHU squared, it also reduces M stop squared. But the other squarks don't have this large Yukawa, so they basically don't run, or they run up from the color, which is neglected here. Second, if you look at the form of the mass matrix at the electroweak scale, you get the diagonal soft terms that basically will determine the mass, and some small V-term corrections. But for the off-diagonal terms, you get something proportional to the mass of the associated fermion. So except for the stop, where you have a top mass here, this term is numerically negligible, and it's mostly the soft mass. But for this one, all the terms of this matrix can be of the same order, and so it can have a small determinant and a suppression of one eigenvalue. Finally, you expect it's the right-handed one, because there's a constraint from the standard model rho parameter, the ratio of the Z to the W mass, which, as long as you have Higgs doublets in the theory, has to be 1. And then there are radiative corrections to that, which go like the splitting in doublets. So they go like the splitting m top squared minus mb squared. And this is the this sensitivity is the main way that the top mass was measured at LEP. But there's also a contribution from this splitting of this doublet. So if you have a light mass, then you get a big shift in this. Experimentally, to about 1 part in 10 to the 3, this is 1. And this is for the left-handed pieces of the squirt doublet that couple to the W. But right-handed stops aren't affected by this argument. So you expect that it's a right-handed stop, most likely, that's or mainly a right-handed stop that's coming in. Those are details, but they're kind of interesting things to tell you the kinds of things we can do with this kind of physics. Let's derive one Feynman rule so you see where they come from. The rest are following pretty much the same way. So if you express the fields in terms of the rotated and mass eigenstates, so there's the angle alpha and the angle beta when you do that rotation, and then go to the standard model Lagrangian or the supersymmetric version. So for example, to see the Z coupling, you just have the squares of these terms in the effective Lagrangian. Now if you substitute this stuff in there, you get these two terms, which gives you a sine beta minus alpha here for the Higgs Z coupling once there's a bev of one of the Higgs fields. This is the standard model piece, this coefficient. So you see that the supersymmetric Higgs is produced with a suppression proportional to the sine of beta minus alpha. So everything else being equal, it might have a smaller production cross-section at LEP, and I'll come back to that in a minute. For the fermions, you get the same, just substituting in again, you get the, I mean the charged ones and the fermions, you get the same stuff. And in particular, if you look at the couplings of the two little and big H, then you get the sum of the projection operators from the chiral SU2 couplings. So those couple like scalars. But if you look at the other one called A, you get the difference, so it has a gamma 5 coupling. That's why at tree level we call this a pseudoscalar and these scalars. So you can see how the whole six Higgs sector works. Then for all of the couplings, to up and down type stuff and gauge bosons, for all of the neutral particles, you get these kinds of coefficients, basically just depending on those angles, alpha and beta. An interesting one is that there's an HZA coupling, but no AAZ coupling and so forth. These are predictions of supersymmetry that these are zero and those are non-zero, for example, independent even of the angles. So all this stuff is worked out in a fair amount of detail. If you're going to talk about going to experiments, you have to ask about how the Higgs decays. And because the Higgs couples to mass, then there's a factor of the mass of any particle at that vertex. And so you have to basically look at the experiments you can do. The threshold for decaying into two W's is above the mass of any Higgs you could have produced at LEP, not at Fermilab. Similarly to Z's, the top is above any of them. But the most common decay will then be to the B mass, and it goes like the square of the mass, so B over tau is a factor of 3 or so squared. And BB bar is the main way things should show up. The lifetime is 1 over the width. The width of a Higgs decay will be basically a weak coupling times the Higgs mass times that ratio squared. So in seconds units, it'll be very small. It can go a tiny fraction of a centimeter. So all you'll ever see in an experiment are the decay products of the Higgs, not any explicit sign itself. Since B quarks have a lifetime 10 to minus 13 seconds about, they can go enough of a centimeter so that you can effectively see them with vertex detectors at colliders. You don't literally see the B, but you see the particles from the B decay project back to a point which isn't the point where the particle was produced. So you can look for BB bar states, then you measure the effective mass of two. If the Higgs decays to a B and a B bar, you look for two of those late decaying states, for example, and then you form the effective mass, and if you find a number of events with a given effective mass, more than the random distribution you would expect from QCD, then you have seen a signal for a Higgs, and that's basically how one looks experimentally. The ratio of branching ratios to different pairs at low masses, and here's the mass where LEP might have seen some kind of signal. I'll come to that in a minute. So it's dominated by the Bs. As you get up to heavier masses, the W and Z decays that I'll have in the next transparency come in. Small decays like muon pairs are very suppressed, but at LHC, you might be able to see something like that and measure the mass dependence. The decay to charm and strange is probably impossible to see under any conditions because it's too difficult to actually identify those guys. The branching ratio to gauge particles is here. So again, in the region around where there might be experimental numbers, you can see that the WW branching ratio is getting actually up toward where the BB bar one was, but not a big part of it. But if you get up over 150 or 160, the W pairs are beginning to actually dominate. Decay to gluons is, again, very difficult to untangle, so probably useless. The interesting decay is gamma-gamma. That's got a branching ratio in the standard model. These are all standard model branching ratios. You can study all of the supersymmetry ones by varying those angles alpha and beta, but and you get variations that are interesting, but we won't take time to do that. This is 10 to the minus 3. At LHC, you can't use the others very well, but you can see photons at the LHC, and you can form a mass of a photon pair with pretty good resolution. So actually, this tiny branching ratio is probably the favored way to see a Higgs signal, and certainly in this region, it is the favored way. It's getting a little more difficult down here. But it is the favored way to see a Higgs signal at the LHC, even though it's rare, because the dominant production mode will still give you, leave you thousands of gamma-gamma events that you can see with much less background. The decay width in general is here, so you can see that as a function of the Higgs mass, the decay width stays quite small. And basically, at any collider, the Higgs is a massless, a width, particle with zero width. It always is in one experimental bin of the collider resolution. Tangent beta is really interesting. It isn't in the high-scale theory, remember. You don't calculate tangent beta in a string theory. You must do the renormalization group running until you generate VEVs, and then you take the ratio. Once you do that, the Yukawa couplings at top and bottom are determined with a tangent beta in them. And we have that strong evidence from the gauge coupling unification and from the electroweak symmetry breaking that the theory stays perturbative at high scales. Therefore, you don't want any part of it to get non-perturbative. So you can impose a constraint that these Yukawa couplings don't get very large. They would if tangent beta were smaller than about 1.2 or greater than about 60. The upper limit is really very vague. It could be plus or minus 10, because when this gets large, there are lots of corrections you have to include, and this is just ignoring those corrections. Tangent beta is not measured or limited yet. You will see in the literature limits on it that they're all incorrect. They all come from specific assumptions in models and are simply not true in any general case. And I've already remarked on how the LEP limit that the standard model I take should be greater than about 115 requires that this be saturate its bound of mz squared, which implies tangent beta is greater than that. But we don't know that the Higgs is standard model-like, and I'll show you examples briefly where it's not. Another indication, which I'll elaborate on a little bit later, the g minus 2 of the muon, the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, is approximately 3 standard deviations from its standard model value experimentally, which is surprising and nice. The situation is interesting because the supersymmetry loop diagram you would expect naively would be less than approximately the standard model loop diagram, but to get something three times the electroweak contribution, you need something about three times bigger. However, the supersymmetry loop is proportional to tangent beta once tangent beta gets noticeably away from one. And so that, again, is suggestive of tangent beta being somewhat larger. But the uncertainties are such that you can't really conclude that. But it's, again, suggestive that tangent beta is a few or greater. Let me finish today by giving you the general limit. The limit on the Higgs mass I gave you so far is in the MSSM. But we were able to find, a decade ago, a completely general limit in the sense that as long as the theory stays perturbative to the high scale, which we assume because of the evidence of the gauge coupling unification and the electroweak symmetry breaking, then no matter how many Higgs multiplets of what kind are in the theory, no matter how supersymmetry is broken for any general supersymmetry breaking Lagrangian at any number, any Higgs sector whatsoever, any number of vacuum expectation values, you can get a general upper limit on the mass. There's no elegant argument, I know, but basically our argument was sort of a semi-brute force one like this. Write down the mass matrix for the Higgs sector, and in the upper left-hand corner, put the two pieces that give the dominant mass to the Z and the W. But you can have a very big matrix. Then you can show just by inspection for any model you ever write, and you can see why when you look at the details, that you can write it in this funny form, a function J times tangent beta plus a function K, J plus a function L, and minus J cotangent beta plus the same function K. And J is basically an unknown function. It depends on the supersymmetry breaking parameters, the mu parameter, extra Higgs valves, all sorts of stuff. Lambdas are couplings in the scalar part of the theory besides the normal ones. But these functions K and L don't depend on the soft breaking or on the extra new valves in the Higgs sector, only on these the coefficients of the couplings of the Higgses, but not on the other stuff. And then you just notice essentially a straightforward fact that the trace of this matrix is proportional to J, and the determinant is also proportional to J because the J squared term cancels from this piece up here. The eigenvalue of this piece isn't, in general, the mass squared of the lightest Higgs, but there's a theorem about matrices that the lowest eigenvalue of a positive definite matrix is always less than the smaller eigenvalue of any 2x2 one. And what we want is the lowest eigenvalue of the full matrix, but we can put an upper bound on it from this 2x2 submatrix. And it doesn't depend on J, since only one eigenvalue can grow as J grows. And so we can actually get an upper limit. Then you have to look at the different terms one by one. If you look at the MSSM itself, there's the matrix, and you can identify for practice J and K and L, and you get this, you can reproduce this bound that way. This is as easy a way as any to do that. You can add one singlet to the theory, in which case the superpotential has terms involving the singlet then, and couplings like that, and one lambda coupling that singlet to the Higgses. And then you can calculate the soft potential from that. In the upper left-hand corner, you can identify those terms. J is complicated, but the determinant isn't. To bound the upper left-hand corner, you have to look at these couplings and put an upper bound on them where the theory stays perturbative. But that they only vary logarithmically if you do their renormalization group running. So you see that that works. And you get an upper bound, which is about 200 GeV, which is an absolute upper bound. You don't calculate it very accurately. No one's done the work to calculate it accurately. You could calculate it to 5 to 10%, but no one cares because we expect to find a lighter Higgs. But there is an absolute upper bound on the Higgs mass in any supersymmetric theory that has gauge coupling unification perturbatively, for example. And that's the only upper bound on any supersymmetric type parameter, mass parameter of any kind. So that bound must not be violated, or the whole approach is simply not relevant to physics. So I will conclude with today's Higgs sector stuff. I'll do a little tiny bit of Higgs sector stuff next time. Let me conclude with two graphs that just show you that there is, in fact, an upper bound on a Higgs mass experimentally. At LEP, what you do is measure Z decays to 20-some independent channels. That is 20-some independent measurements at the Z. And every parameter of the standard model is known except the Higgs mass. So you simply ask at LEP, how do I get a description of the observed 20-some parameters, which gives a reasonable chi-square in the sense of a global fit? Then you decide a chi-square greater than some number isn't acceptable, and you read across, and you get an upper limit. This graph is determined by the experimental data. The details don't matter at all, but somewhere around 200 GeV, and it's exponentially sensitive, so whether it's 200 or 180 or 270, 250, 225, you can't really decide. But there's an upper limit of some mass like that from the LEP global fit data, not an explicit thing, global fit data at LEP. So something has to exist below that upper limit that plays the role of a Higgs particle. There's another independent way of studying that by combining LEP and Fermilab data. You plot the measurement of the top quark mass and the W mass with the best values from LEP and Fermilab, if you like. And then these lines are different Higgs masses, and the combined data, for example, is this blob, which again gives you an upper limit a little over 200 GeV on the Higgs mass. If you whether this is a better indication or this is unclear, you can't really tell, because all the data is not the best data you could get with high statistics and so forth. But somewhere there's an upper limit on the Higgs mass. This argument for it is independent of the other one, because this uses, for example, W masses and Fermilab top quark mass measurements. So there are two separate indications that there is, in fact, a Higgs boson existing in the world with a mass less than somewhere around 200 GeV. Next time I'll talk a little bit more about that before I move toward the super partners themselves and how to see that.